When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind. The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Welcome back to this very special two-part episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast, talking about Mr. Pierce Brosnan, the fifth actor to play James Bond. If you've listened to the first part, then you will have gone on a journey with us from Pierce's birth to him landing the role of James Bond. Finally, what an odyssey that was. And now we're finally getting to the meat and potatoes of it, his actual Bond films. So, yeah, a lot to talk about, but... Yeah, we don't generally talk too much about our opinions on this show. It's often, I mean, they leak out occasionally, but we will be giving our opinions about the films in this episode. So I'm quite excited to talk about his four Bond films, which we've all watched again very recently. But I guess really to start us off, before we dive into GoldenEye, we should talk a little bit about the context that he joined the franchise in, which was, you know, after a six-year hiatus with Timothy Dalton leaving the role, and in a brand new decade, in the 90s. And so what was Bond's,
After a lot of political, kind of economic world factors that had changed over the course of that time, it was...
Sure, yeah.
It was a massive shift for the Bond series. And I mean, a lot of people thought that it wouldn't continue just because it was an old dinosaur-like character that just existed in the past.
Well, was it the Cold War ended, or the Berlin Wall came down in 89, didn't it, when they were making License to Kill, or after it had come out, I can't remember. So, yeah, this was the first Cold War Bond film. And so, Wheatley, you've been looking into the character, unusual really for a film, but the sort of a character Bible that was conceived at that time for Bond.
Yes. Well, let me paint a picture of the late 80s, early 90s, where there is this delay in Bond and there's an uncertainty. And the last two Bond films that have been made, they did okay, but they certainly didn't extend the life of Bond with people saying, we're going to make 10 more. That wasn't a certainty by any stretch of the imagination. And that's not all. There was, of course, the Cubby Broccoli changeover, which, although didn't officially happen until GoldenEye came around, there must have been discussions about, you know, the changing of hands to Wilson and Barbara. So this whole period was a very tricky time, and there's a lot of uncertainty, especially with MGM as well. There was a lot happening there with how the films are going to be made, who would own the whole of the Bond series. So, yeah, a lot happening and a lot of uncertainty. So in comes a gentleman called John Cork. Now, John Cork he's basically a man whose life largely is based on Bond. He's one of the foremost Bond knowledges in the world. He's written loads and loads of books, and some of them are quite famous. One with a gentleman called Bruce Scavalli, and that's the James Bond... I've got it here, actually. James Bond, The Legacy. That's what it's called. Fantastic book.
Beautiful hardcover book, isn't it?
Yeah. So Cork, he kind of works as this expert, and he creates documentaries for all of the Bond DVDs and separate programs. He writes loads of articles on Bond, and he's just basically famous for just having this massive knowledge of Bond and being involved with various projects that sit around it. But his history is quite interesting. I won't go into too much depth about him because it's not specifically about Brosnan. But he, whilst working through his Bond projects and things like that, he eventually got involved with the actual, like the Broccolis, in pulling together the scripts for GoldenEye. And it's his agent who got him kind of pitch to Broccoli and Wilson about what he could do and get him involved to help write the new script. And there's lots of information about kind of how he got involved in it and what he did. But in reality, a lot of the scripts he wrote and a lot of the treatments, they never got picked. He was never a script writer on the Bond films. And he talks about that in quite a lot of depth, where he's saying, yeah, he was never meant to be a script writer. But whilst doing it, he oddly got involved with Barbara to write this kind of Bible. It's called the Bond in the 1990s character Bible. And it's him and Barbara basically just read all of the Bond books, went back through all the films and just kind of reviewed what Bond was and what it should be in the future. And they asked loads of questions throughout this whole process, where they were just meeting up every day, having these chats, going through what they should do. Things like, which James Bond are we developing those ideas for? What was different about each book? Who is James Bond in the novels? How is this expressed in the films? How should it be expressed today? And it was something that had never really been done before. It was this transitional time where nobody had the answers to these questions. And if they'd just done it based on previous films, they probably wouldn't have evolved it in the way that they did. So he just wrote this kind of big Bible, and it doesn't exist as a, it's not a book, it's not a, it doesn't exist, you can't buy it, but it's just a big pile of notes that he's pulled together, which he suggests that they're still using to this very day, and there might be numerous rewrites of it and people might be adding to it. Nobody really knows. But yeah, that's kind of the springboard for it, and it's shaped what the decisions that they made as they kind of pulled in Brosnan and started making GoldenEye.
It'd be amazing to have a look through those documents.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much... He doesn't really talk in depth about what's in it. He just really says what it was. But I can imagine there's a lot of Craig stuff in there as well. I mean, it's got to have so many ideas in it.
I think one of the cornerstones from what I understand is that the times have changed, but Bond hasn't. And I think that really defines the Brosnan era in a way, right? Because what we see across his four films is very much a bringing up to date of the, let's say, the milieu that Bond lives in, the MI6, the cars, the gadgets. They're all very much, you know, up to 89, they're all very much rooted in the past. But Bond, in the Brosnan era, really starts to look forward to the future, right?
Yeah, there's quite an interesting quote that he says about it. He explains that it's just a really detailed document, but he talks about how they could hand it to screenwriters or departments or business people and say, this is what we work from. You can use it if you want. You may not want to do it, but this is where we start off from. So when they come up with these ideas, they're not just starting from zero. Because there's a lot of people who probably come to work on it and they're not a Bond knowledge. They don't have a style sheet for Bond, but this is essentially a style sheet for Bond. And you can go through it and go, actually, cross that out because that we're not having that in anymore. We're changing that. But it just gives us something to work
with. It's a common concept in TV, especially on sitcoms and animated shows. And I know from reading the Mark Edlitz book recently, that James Bond Jr. had a very similar character Bible, which sort of explains everything about the character and everything about the world. And to have that... Yeah. is really important, especially in that period in the 90s, where they don't know exactly what Bond is. This is a time to say, this is what Bond is, and this is who he is, and this is where Pierce Brosnan steps into, right?
Yeah, I imagine it's a necessity. And as those, it was probably as a response to, I mean, you've got 30 years of films or around that before GoldenEye, and if you don't like hold it in, anything could happen. You've got to realize, you've got to have some kind of structure behind it. Otherwise, it's just going to mess. I don't imagine like the Fast and the Furious films have one, but if they eventually got to a few more films, they might start saying, right, we need to have some consistency here. But yeah, that's probably the most important thing that's happened in terms of the kind of storyline before GoldenEye, and sets up quite nicely as to the decisions that were made and everything that happened after that, really.
Let's dive into GoldenEye then. So, who wants to start off by talking about GoldenEye? Obviously, this is Brosnan's debut, 1995. I think I'm going to just put it out there. I think it's his best Bond film. I don't think that's bold a claim.
Yeah, I'd agree with that completely. Yeah, it's the only one that I ever really think I really want to watch this film.
What do you think about Brosnan in this film?
I think he's a little bit wet behind the ears, and that crops up in a lot of interviews that you see with him. Obviously, he's new to the role. I imagine out of all of the Bonds, that was probably one of the most difficult first Bond films to do because there was so much uncertainty. There's four Bonds before you that have done it, so it must get increasingly hard every time to kind of follow up what you're doing. But yeah, I think he's brilliant in it. He really does a good job.
Yeah, I think right from the get-go, that iconic opening scene and his first delivery of the Bond, James Bond line, I don't think he falters. Maybe he's a bit nervous, like you say. He's not quite got into the confidence of the role yet, but you never doubt for a second that he is Bond.
Yeah, absolutely. That first scene just gives me chills thinking about it. The dive off the dam.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not him a lot of the time, which is quite interesting. I think you get the close-up of the eyes.
Yeah.
But then when you do finally see him, you got to say, he is devastatingly handsome.
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
yeah, absolutely looks the part. He looks like the lady killer that you expect James Bond to be.
But perfect for when it was released as well, because but people say, oh, he's quite like Moore, he's quite like Sean Connery. He's not, like, to put him next to them, he's not very similar to any of those. He's his own Bond, and as soon as he starts, you go, "Oh, this is interesting." I can stick with this.
He's closer looking to Dalton, right? I think you could say the same about Dalton. He is an impressive man to look at in those two films. And Brosnan comes in, and he's a bit more matinee idol than Dalton, but he just has the delivery and the timing that is just absolutely perfect for Bond.
Yeah.
And he looks like he can handle himself when in the fight scenes. I mean, apart from the sound effects that he makes, which get gradually more crazy as they go on. But in GoldenEye, he looks the part. He walks the walk. He talks he talks the talk, and his accent goes a bit all over the place in places. But
But the great thing about it is there was such a gap before that moment, but it's not. Like, this is an introduction to a new Bond, but it doesn't feel like it. You totally believe that he's Bond. It's not, you don't step back. Like,
yeah, there was definitely none of the Daniel Craig stuff.
No, exactly, like with Daniel Craig. Yeah. So, yeah, I just think it was great. It's a great script as well, which, you know.
Yeah, it really barrels along at a great pace, I think. It's got a great villain. Honor Top is great.
Yeah.
I always forget what the other lady's called, but Isabella Scarpino, she's great as well.
Yeah,
it's funny. It's got a good twist. And what's interesting from reading about it, it's one of the lower budget Bonds, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
It was made at a cut price, and I think that really helps it. Especially when we look at the ones that come after, because I think they're very, very economical with what they do.
Yeah,
and there's no big crowd scenes.
Nope.
Any action sequences are very closely choreographed and in a very tight, controlled environment, which just really helps, I think.
And they used a lot of miniatures in that as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
To save, and it looks so impressive. Like, I didn't even know until I'd watched a documentary about the making that a lot of it was modelled.
With Derek Meddings, isn't it? His final film. Did many of the Bond films, but... yeah, I think obviously the one thing I think that always lets that film down is the soundtrack, which we've mentioned before.
It really is the weak point. But that's not Brosnan's fault.
Not Brosnan's fault. Let's move on from Eric Serra. Let's save that for that. And I guess the thing about Brosnan in that film, he looks the part. He really takes the role with both hands and goes for it. And actually something I really enjoy about that first film is how it's a reboot, and they just sort of start again with the world of Bond. You've got the new M.
Yeah.
You've got a new MI6 headquarters, which I just love that world with the beige like corridors and all that sort of stuff. But also they give you the nuggets of, you know, the DB5 and the callbacks, the Cold War. It's post Cold War, but it's about the Cold War as well.
Yeah.
It does change the format of Bond a bit. Not a lot. It's still firmly rooted in the previous films. And it's the same with Brosnan. He's not a new Bond in the Daniel Craig sense. They've not completely come up with a new character and changed the whole format. He's still the same Bond. They've just slightly tweaked it so that he's a bit different. And I think, and you, as you were saying, Brendan, that's why people accepted it. It wasn't too scary. Nobody complained. Everyone thought he was going to be Bond 5 years earlier anyway, 6 years earlier. Mm. So it wasn't a surprise when he came around. There's probably part of it where they said, well, we've already kind of done this, so don't have to worry about any problems with him coming in.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was definitely, he just fit rather nicely into that role, and it wasn't a surprise to anyone.
Yeah. Interestingly, that first, the opening scene at the beginning, that is set in 1986.
Ah, how interesting.
When he originally got the role. So maybe they did that on purpose, but I thought that was quite a nice nod to the fact he did get to play Bond in 1986, after all.
How funny. Yes. That's good. I never noticed that. It's a great what if, isn't it? Like, what if he had got the role at that point? Would we have got a film like this? Who knows?
Well, I didn't know when to talk about this until the end or the start of his film series, but I think that is an interesting point, and it does crop up in a lot of the documentation and websites and stuff I've read, is that he often says that he's glad he didn't get it in the 80s. He's glad that he didn't get it in 1986 because he wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And you can imagine that. When you see him at the start of GoldenEye, he seems... I know he's not young, but he seems quite young in it. He's quite fresh-faced. You imagine that 6 years younger, it's going to have a different feeling altogether. It seemed like he came in at the right time, and he's obviously done a lot more work. There was a load more films he'd done between that time period. He just says he's more confident and he was ready for it, and that's quite important. And I imagine they're so careful not to get people in who aren't ready for it because it just won't work.
But also, who's to say if he had got it in the 80s, there still would have been that dispute anyway in the 90s. So would he have come back after that? You know, who knows?
That's an interesting, interesting thing to ponder, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I guess also the fact that he got it later was enabled him to go from Remington Steel to do a few big movies, right, and earn that experience to be able to step onto a Bond set and just command the performance that he does.
But
it's just such.
There's a thing I also find about Brosnan from reading about all of his kind of history, and he's got a very, and we've talked about this in the previous podcast, about all the things that have happened to him. He's got such a kind of complex life, and it's a lot of, you know, heartache and problems that have happened throughout it. And he was still going through that during this whole period before GoldenEye. There was a lot of stuff he had to go through. And I always feel that in his earlier days, he felt like he was desperate for the fame and he was desperate to make a name for himself. But in reading the stuff up until GoldenEye, it didn't seem like that was the most important thing anymore, because he'd kind of got that out of his way. He'd done a lot more since then, so he was ready for Bond then. He wasn't just chasing the fame and the role. He'd grown into it, and he did it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Shall we move?
That's just my take, though.
Shall we move on from GoldenEye?
Yes, let's do it.
So, what happened after GoldenEye?
So, when becoming Bond, he asked Eon if he was allowed to work on other projects in between the Bond films, and they gave him the request. They said he could do that, and so in between he would make films in between being in the other Bonds. So he also formed a production company in 1996 called Irish Dreamtime, and that was with his longtime friend Beau St. Clair. And he says, when GoldenEye had the success it had, we said, let's make movies, let's step forth and create our own projects. And it's as simple as that, really. So they established the production company, and they had the backing from MGM, so that obviously helps. And they went on to produce 12 films. The first one was called The Nephew in 1998. And the second one is probably the biggest and most well-known. It's The Thomas Crown Affair. We'll cover later on in the episode, because there's a lot of films that he's involved with. But he said about the production company, "The films I've made with this company are close to my heart. The Greatest being one of them and Evelyn being another." So this is a kind of a passion project for him. Everything he gets scripts sent and he'll do it if he wants, you know, if it interests him or it means something to him. Sadly, in 2016, Beau St. Clair died at the age of 63 after a 10-year battle with ovarian cancer. And if you remember from the previous podcast, his wife died also from ovarian cancer. So it's another pang of tragedy for Pierce. And he said, "Beau was the sister I never had, my dearest friend for 30 years. She was a wonderful, beautiful woman in every way. She had style, grace, humour, intellect and a kind heart that I will forever miss." So since 2016, the company hasn't made any more. I guess it might not be something he wants to pursue without Beau. So as well as that, he was in Mars Attacks. Probably remember he was the Professor Donald Kessler.
I remember that well. Didn't we go to cinema to see that, Butler?
Yeah, he's a head in a jar, isn't he? Well, that's how he ends up.
He is later on, yeah.
Yeah, I watched the clip and it's just his head rolling around. So he did that. Hugh Grant was actually supposed to be cast in that role, but Pierce Brosnan came along and...
Also touted to be Bond at one point.
I know. Yeah, there's quite a bit of crossover with Brosnan and co-stars and people he's replaced. Yeah. He did Robinson Crusoe, if you remember. He was just going off to shoot that when he got the Bond role when he was revealed at the press conference. An absolute flop by all accounts.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a lot of flops, isn't there, in this?
There is a flop. There is a lot of flops, yeah. And Dante's Peak.
It's one of those films that I've never seen. And I don't know why, because I feel like I know it very well. But didn't it come around the same time as Volcano or something?
There is a rival Volcano film that came out at the same time, wasn't there?
Yeah, I always get them mixed up.
Well, this was 1997. Yeah, and he played the lead role. So that was his gap in between Goldeneye and Tomorrow Never Dies.
It's a good gap. He's got a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, and he's created a production company. So,
well, a lot of the earlier, they were a lot stricter with the earlier Bonds, weren't they, with the films that they could make. But by the time it got around to Brosnan, they seemed a lot more open to other films happening. And films where, what were those early rules that they used to have with, like, Connery and Moore and Lazenby, where you couldn't act in a film unless they signed it off and said, "That's fine, that works for Bond. You can't have long hair or something in a film." Yeah. But yeah, he's definitely not fitting by any rules, is he, making these films?
So then we come to Tomorrow Never Dies. So we're in this great period for Brosnan and the Bond films where they were able to bash them out every other year. So we had Goldeneye in 95, Tomorrow Never Dies in 97. From all accounts, this was a bit of a tumultuous production. They didn't really have a script when they started. They really struggled to nail what the script would be beforehand. It's the one where they had a whole writer's room, including Nicholas Meyer. He came up with the idea, I think, of the media mogul maybe he didn't come up with the idea of the media mogul, but basically it was a bunch of writers and they were brought in to try and crack the script. And yeah, I think that caused possible tensions on the film. And I really feel like you can get that sense when you watch Tomorrow Never Dies.
Well, I read that MGM had given a ridiculously tight deadline. They wanted it done by December 1997 and it had to be done by then. And Wilson says it was the tightest deadline they'd ever done. It was almost impossible to do that. So, what did he say? If the script isn't right, you push back the production. You don't launch unless the script's right. But they couldn't do that. That's probably why they had so many script writers to try and make up the time. But it was a really crammed shoot. And I mean, that was just the start of the problems. There were loads more problems with Spottiswood and arguments on set and all this kind of stuff from what I've heard, where... Yeah, it definitely wasn't a smooth sailing production.
Brosnan himself didn't get on with Terry Hatcher, did he?
No, he didn't.
Yeah, it's. I guess we'll cover that when we get to Carver, C for Carver, in that episode. Yeah. But I mean, that can't help, right? Particularly when I understood that he wanted Terry Hatcher for the film as well.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, I read that I think it was Spottiswood who wanted Terry Hatcher, but there were other people in the running for it as well that the rest of the production crew would have preferred. But yeah, there's quite a lot of quotes from him where it's a bit like the Roger Moore, Grace Jones scenario where he's got a few quotes that I'll read you one here just to finish it off. But she acquitted herself grandly in many ways. I am sure she will learn as she goes on. A bit of humanity and a bit of grace and a bit of charm go a long way. Which, sums it up quite nicely from Pierce.
So yeah, what do you make of this film overall?
The film's very poor, and I would say it's the weakest of his four.
Wow, bold claim.
Bold claim.
No, I'd agree. But... Well, actually, no, I'd agree to an extent. I think as a whole, it's probably the weakest consistently.
Yeah,
the package. The whole film just kind of blends into one high-octane amorphous series of events for me. I can't remember anything where I really like a scene. But having said that, it's just... If you like that, you've got a consistent run of action and you know, that kind of stuff. So
I don't think Brosnan's at fault, though.
Not at all.
No, he's
not
good in it. This is not
his fault. Yeah, if there's one, you know, positive, it is Brosnan's performance.
Yeah. Well, Wilson said of Brosnan in the film, in Pierce we have a Bond who is now confident and comfortable in the role. And you can see that. He is very confident. He apparently put on quite a lot of muscle as well for the role, so he's a bit bulkier. He just looked confident and like you'd expect from Bond. The difference between him in GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies is quite different in terms of how kind of sure they are of themselves. He looks imposing, doesn't he? He looks quite dangerous.
Yeah.
But this film obviously benefits from having the David Arnold score over the last one. So this starts to feel... You know, GoldenEye, you would almost say, stands alone from his following three films in that it is quite different, whereas the next three, Tomorrow Never Dies, World Is Not Enough, Die Another Day, feel very much three of a part, right? And that's part of that is David Arnold. But I think he's great in it. I think I really like Wei Lin, the Michelle Yeoh character. Don't really buy their chemistry together. The stuff with Terry...
There's not a lot of chemistry... with anyone in the film, really. I don't think any of the actors work well together. Even like Jonathan Pryce, he just seems...
The concept...
Not a pun on the film, but a fish out of water.
The concept's great, though, I think. The idea of a media mogul who can control the news and who can, like, start wars and end wars. Yeah. I think that's really interesting. And you can sort of see where it's coming from. But I just... This film, for me, it's just a slog. It really is a slog from start to finish.
For me, it's a lot of writers throwing lots of ideas, and on paper, the media mogul, you know, setting up walls is a good idea, but it's not in the film context. It isn't, and one of the problems with it is it's not a timeless Bond film because it's so dated. So many factors in it that are dated. Some of the actors are dated. Some of the scenes that just don't work anymore. Whereas look at some of the older Bonds, they steer away from trend-based things going on. GoldenEye doesn't really have any of that, and that's what makes GoldenEye timeless, I think, in that it doesn't matter when you watch it. Whereas, Tomorrow Never Dies, it just seems like a 90s film. You watch one of those 90s films like True Lies. True Lies was a big factor, isn't it, in the early Bond, Brosnan Bonds, where I think they watched True Lies and said, oh, we can't release a Bond that's not as good as True Lies. We've got to match it for pace, for special effects, for actors, and they tried that, and that for me, Tomorrow Never Dies feels like they're trying to make a True Lies, but not quite right. Well,
it's got that whole open sequence, hasn't it, with the jet planes being used like in a shootout. That's very True Lies in itself, right?
But exactly, Brosnan, not his fault. He's very good in it. I think he does a tremendous job in it, and he's enjoyable to watch in it.
Yeah, that stuff. I like this stuff again. Like I said, with Michelle Yeoh in. Where they're supposed to be in... I don't even know where they're supposed to be. Is it supposed to be in Vietnam, but...
Shanghai.
Is it? Yeah.
Is it Shanghai?
Wherever they filmed it. I love that stuff on the motorbike. That's just classic Bond to me. Yeah. And he really pulls that off.
Yeah.
And then the stuff in the shower afterwards, you know, that to me is vintage Bond, and that's Brosnan at his best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's peak Bond in this. I think he was just, everything about him was just, he hit the high notes in terms of everything he did. He looked, he sounded, he was just good. It's just a shame that I didn't get to use it better.
Yeah, dealt with poor script. It's really frustrating.
Mm. Dealt a lot of poor stuff in that film.
So what happens after Tomorrow Never Dies for Brosnan?
He goes on and makes some more films in the gap. 1998 he does Quest for Camelot and The Nephew, but 1999 is where he makes Thomas Crown Affair, which was a huge success. It's a remake of the 1968 Steve McQueen.
A surprise success after a series of remakes that did very badly in Hollywood.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a slight bit of backlash about him playing the lead role as well. But I watched it the other day, and yeah, it still stands up now. It's like 22 years on, and it's a solid fare. And he plays a billionaire who steals art for fun, basically. That's the easiest way of putting it. And the investigator, he ropes her into his world, and a bit of cat and mouse ensues. It's good. I enjoyed it, and I think, again, he's very good in it. You know, charming, suave, classic Brosnan.
They're remaking it again, I think.
Wouldn't surprise
me. Are
they? Yeah, I think, I don't know if I remember this right, Michael B. Jordan possibly doing it, but it's a good concept.
Never beat Brosnan. Before we go on to his next film, he also, and this was actually, I couldn't quite get the time right of this, but he also got his star on the Walk of Fame in Hollywood. Mm. I think this was during filming for Tomorrow Never Dies, because Michelle Yeoh and Desmond Llewellyn were there at the time where he was doing this little speech. And there's not a lot of information about it. It doesn't seem like a massive thing, really. He does a bit of a speech at the event. Really short speech. It's like, I don't know, 20 seconds, and then just goes off, and then does a couple of interviews. But yeah, it's if you're interested, it's 7021 Hollywood Boulevard, and it's been there from the 12th of March 1997. So if you're ever in town, check it out.
So now we come to Brosnan's third film. The third film on his James Bond deal, in fact, The World Is Not Enough. This is released in 1999. For me, personally, I think it's a step up in quality from Tomorrow Never Dies. But actually, when you read online, that's not necessarily the consensus No. among Bond fans. Mm-hmm. Many Bond fans think Tomorrow Never Dies is the superior film to The World Is Not Enough. This, yeah. But yeah. I'm not sure entirely sure why that is. I think The World Is Not Enough is, it's pretty good. It's got, you know, it's got its faults, but it's also got a lot of interesting stuff going on in it. This is obviously the one with Reynard and Electra and the oil pipeline. There is some weird stuff that goes on in it, like the whole caviar thing. And don't think, obviously we get introduced to John Cleese as Q, and not a fan of that. And also, why does MI6 spend all its time in Scotland? I'm never really sure.
Yeah, it's
is that
strange,
explained?
Isn't it?
Like they go to the funeral and they just stay there in Scotland. There. Is it because of it's the explosion in MI6?
Yeah, but it doesn't wipe the face of it off like
in Skyfall.
No, it's just one room, isn't it?
Wait, is it Skyfall that happens in? Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah,
but actually I feel like it makes much more of an attempt to entertain the audience, and it moves along at a much more interesting pace, I think, than Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah.
It's much more cohesive.
Yeah.
And again, Brosnan just seems to be really enjoying himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, World Is Not Enough is, I think, it's seen by a lot of people, and probably by Wilson and Barbara, that was the first real chat. Because of the problems on Tomorrow Never Dies, this was the first time they they realised the mistakes they'd made on Tomorrow Never Dies. Obviously, GoldenEye, Cubby was still around. It wasn't all their decisions. Tomorrow Never Dies was the first Broccoli Wilson produced Bond film, but it had a lot of problems. And The World's Not Enough, they wanted to right the wrongs of Tomorrow Never Dies. They wanted to give it more time. They wanted to get a really detailed script in and really put the effort in. And I think that shows. And I think there's quite a lot of interesting references to the film. But there's one which Neil Purvis, who's one of the script writers on it, he talks a bit about how they wanted to make it more Hitchcockian and add a bit more depth to the kind of story and a little bit more twisty. And there is a twist in it, which, I mean, it's not exactly Hitchcockian, but it's definitely a little bit more involved than a lot of the kind of more simpler. And Tomorrow Never Dies, certainly, at no point would you class that as Hitchcockian. And then Brosnan, when he talks about The World Is Not Enough, he says he kind of embraced this ability to kind of show off what he could do. And he says, I don't just want to run around with a machine gun from start to finish. Having big, punchy set pieces is a hallmark of the Bond films, but I also want to be tested as an actor, and my character is more of a flesh and blood man. So you can kind of see he's really looking forward to getting his teeth into something a bit more, and I imagine after Tomorrow Never Dies, that was a welcome treat. And he also talks about how it's just much easier to work on his third film. He no longer had to worry about the press saying he's a new Bond. He didn't feel like he was getting judged every time he did anything. He just and then even in Tomorrow Never Dies, he probably felt a bit of that because, you know, you've done one film. A lot of Bonds have done one film and then the second one isn't quite as good. But he's just felt confident and no longer, you know, under review by everyone, and he just felt he could just embrace it.
I do think this really benefits from, we spoke about Michael Apted in previous episode. It really benefits from his direction as well.
Yeah.
The character is still more fleshed out, and you can see that they've worked, and Elektra is a really good character.
Yeah, well, you can kind of see that there's echoes of what would later come in Casino Royale with Craig, in that they're trying to add depth to Bond. They're trying to make him upset about things. They're trying to make him feel a bit more about the characters like Elektra. And I think to an extent it does work, and he comes off very well in it. I think he looks like a very good actor in it. By far one of the best Bonds acting is in that film.
Yeah.
So possibly it's definitely...
Maybe the torture scene I would question.
Well, yeah. There's a few scenes in it.
Alan Partridge.
But I think this is the problem with the film. I think there's a consistency issue with it. And not as much as Die Another Day, but... You know, you've got the Christmas Jones stuff and you've got some other elements of it where it loses it. I don't know why, but it's not... If they just carried it on as the same style throughout, it would have been good. But, at some point, it just loses a bit of that character consistency.
There's one point that jumps out to me, and it's when... You know when Electric King's on TV crying and he touches the screen?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
It's to show that he's like... got feelings.
You can imagine Sean Connery doing that. Punch the screen.
Yeah.
He's easily aroused, Brosnan.
Yeah. Well, they tried it with Tomorrow Never Dies, didn't they? With Paris, when they tried to make it really somber when she gets killed.
Yeah.
And he's sat depressed. Doesn't work. And obviously tried it again with this one, but taking it a little bit too far with the TV touching.
Mm.
But this one really expands the relationship between Bond and M, I think, which really, really helps to add a bit of depth. And it's the first one, you know, where M really gets pulled into the story in a significant way, which is something that obviously then carries on into the Craig era. You could almost say it's a precursor to the Skyfall situation, right?
Oh, yeah. They've definitely put a lot of more effort into the characters in this. Even the secondary characters are far better. The characters that work for MI6. Who's your favourite character that you're always talking about?
Tanner.
The Tanner in this is very good. He's,
And Colin Salmon as well, the character he plays. Yeah. I really like him.
Yeah.
He's such a good part of the Brosnan era. Again, he was talking about, as I mentioned, the milieu of the Brosnan era. He's such a big part of that.
Yeah,
I love him. I love Tanner. I love M. I love MI6 HQ.
It's all fleshed out, isn't it? It's properly fleshed out. It's not vanity like Tomorrow Never Dies. Everything happens for a reason, to a point, until you get to Christmas Jones. And then as we said in an earlier one, that's the script writer was off that day.
Yeah.
She's I read this right that she wasn't the first choice, and she was a studio hire possibly for that film, Denise Richards. But yeah, I think this is I think this is a solidly, you know, decent Bond film. It's not one of my favourites, but Brosnan's really good in it.
I always look at it as probably the meatier of the four Brosnan films. I think there's more in it than the other ones. It's not my favourite, but I just think there's depth to it. And when I think about it, I don't think about it and think, oh, I don't want to watch that.
Mm. Well, there's depth, it's got budget, it's got a soundtrack that's decent. Yep. So, yeah, it is more of an experience, a Bond experience, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good Saturday afternoon bank holiday job, right? Which I guess they take to another level in the next one. But
the next one. We're not there yet.
So what happens after The World Is Not Enough? Oh, actually, worth mentioning that after The World Is Not Enough, they ran trade adverts for Bond, calling Brosnan their billion-dollar Bond. Have you seen those?
No.
Because his three films had made $1 billion in total, which for him obviously was a huge, you know, seal of approval. And with his contract up, that then left him in a great place to negotiate for the next film. And actually they gave him a bit more time for the next film.
Yeah.
Mm.
So what happened after The World Is Not Enough?
Well, he did one film in between The World Is Not Enough and Die Another Day. And it's another espionage. It's a John le Carré thriller called The Tailor of Panama. Either of you seen this?
It's one of those ones that I've completely forgotten about, but now you've mentioned it, I always thought I should watch that. It hasn't even cropped up in me searching through Amazon and Netflix for films, but yeah, I wouldn't mind giving that a go.
Yeah, me too, after just having a little read. It's got Geoffrey Rush in it, and Pierce Brosnan plays an MI6 spy called Andy Osnard. So, you know, he knows how to play an MI6 agent, doesn't he? So it's got relatively good reviews. So I think that is one to look out for. And then obviously in 2001, the September 11th attacks happened, which then go on to change the course of Bond and have an effect on how the producers treat Bond moving forward. Brosnan basically in that window of the Cold War ending and the War on Terror, he slots right into the middle of that, and then and then that's it.
Bookended.
Yeah. Because then, of course, he goes on to make Die Another Day, and they started production. I think it was a couple of months after the 9/11 attacks. So already it's already in pre-production. So of course, you know, it's going to be made. And obviously, when it's released, well, we're going to talk about it now, but it can seem quite jarring to the world that it's released into in 2002.
Die Another Day, then.
Die Another Day. Finally,
we're here.
Which we really interestingly, we all watched this. Very, very close together. Brendan, you watched it ahead of us. And tell us your initial reaction, because I found it really interesting.
Right, so I went in thinking, this is going to be awful. I don't know how much of this I can even get through. I'm thinking, what point am I going to turn this off? And the opening scene is fantastic. It's a great concept. Bond getting captured. That's fantastic.
Hovercraft.
Yeah, the hovercraft chase. Brilliant. And it kept going on, and I was like, I'm actually enjoying this. And I got to the end and thought it was nowhere near. It's not in my bottom five. I mean, that's, you know, that's a bigger praise I can give it, I think.
And I would say I would agree. I think it was much better than I expected it to be on revisiting. It's not one I revisit very often. I feel like I've watched the start of it quite a few times and either fallen asleep or been too drunk for it or whatever. But it is a great concept. But the problem is it feels like there's a conflict at the heart of it where possibly the writers have wanted to make, because it's the 40th anniversary, right? They wanted to make this 40th anniversary celebration film harking back to the, you know, the classics, and try to make a gritty spy film. And it does have that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And then it just turns into a cartoon. From what I understand, Lee Tamahori had a lot to do with that. He sort of really wanted to push the boundaries of making it cartoony and CGI heavy. Yeah. And that's where the conflict is. But it does get really, it starts off really well. And then when it gets to the Ice Palace and you've got the exploding hand puncher things, whatever they are, the electric gloves. Yeah. And then the lasers, and it's just gadget after gadget after gadget after gadget. Yeah. And it's just like, you just think, you've just gone too far.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to jump on your parade here because I didn't have that response to the film. I didn't think it was as bad as I'd initially thought. Because I don't think I've watched it for about 5 years, maybe more, maybe 8 years or something like that. I think I've actively avoided it every time there's an opportunity to watch a Bond film. Never watch it. But I hate that first sequence where he's captured. I just don't think it's Bond. It just seems there's too much going on there, and him with the beard, and he's had 18 months out. I think it's too much for Bond. I don't want that information about Bond. I don't want him to go that in depth. I don't want him to be a prisoner of war. And part of the reason why I like a lot of the Bond films is that they sit in this kind of silo storyline where the story arc is the one Bond film, and you throw him into it, he deals with it, and he gets out of it. But that,
and then they keep him in cling film until the next one.
Yeah, that's what I want. That's that,
keeping him in permafrost.
Yeah, yeah, it doesn't work for the Craig ones, but with this one, I think this is the first time where they try and pad out like why he's doing stuff later on. Like, he's been there for 18 months. There's a strange question around him not being trustworthy anymore because he might have been, you know, affected by being a prisoner of war for 18 months, which they then forget about quite quickly, and they're not too worried about it. But it just feels like it's quite a big subject to throw in, not to do it properly, because they forget about it quite quickly. And it's like, well, he's just been prisoner of war for 18 months. He's forgotten about that now. It's not affected him in any way. They don't even address it. If that was Craig era, he'd have PTSD. He'd have all sorts of things going on. But
yeah.
It's a semi, like, they're trying to do one film and then ignoring the fact that they've done that, moving on to the next thing, and it just doesn't quite work for me. But what I think Brosnan is very good in it. I think he plays the role brilliantly, and I think there's a very good Bond film in there. So after that first sequence where he goes back, he's in prison war for 18 months, and then that whole, he sees Jinx, he starts doing this quite interesting story arc. There's you're watching it thinking, this is getting good now. I don't know what's happening. There's a few good characters in it. And as you say, it spirals into nonsense. Mm. And I think it's nonsense that it doesn't suit Brosnan. He's too... He's like, not too old, but he's being thrown into a world which is the True Lies world of loads of things going on, lots of technology and all these kind of, like, I won't talk too much about the invisible car, but it just feels like he's out of place. And at one point, he's in place in that film, and it works. And then it shifts, and suddenly you just go, yeah, he's not in the right place anymore. And he hasn't got a hold on that character anymore. And then, yeah, I think that's the same with a lot of the characters in it. I think Jinx starts off promising, and you kind of go, okay, she's quite interesting. I don't even know what she is by the end of it. It's like, she's not even explained. She's just an agent that follows him around, and he saves occasionally. It's just odd. So yeah, I'm not a fan of it, but I think it saddens me because I think it could have been really good if they'd just not messed about with it.
Yeah.
I've got to say, that scene where he meets Gustav Graves in the fencing club, Bar Madonna, I think is absolutely brilliant. Yeah. I think that was the moment where I thought,
yeah,
this is classic Bond. This could have been like,
yeah,
it felt they were setting him up to be like a Hugo Drax type character. Mm. I mean, the plot twist around him doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but...
But I think that scene is a perfect explanation of the film, because that scene could have been perfect, but they messed it up by throwing a Madonna. And everything that happens in that film is like throwing a Madonna all the time. Like, there's a good scene, then suddenly he pulls out this power glove, which has like Lawnmower Man electricity flying out of it. I'm just doing that reference because I've been doing research on Brosnan. But for no reason. There's no reason why Madonna's there. There's no reason why he's got a power glove. The invisible car's almost pointless.
It's in it much less than I remember. Yeah. It's also the windsurfing bit which everyone references as well with the CGI, is in much less than I remember.
Yeah. Probably cost hundreds of thousands of pounds to put all that extra stuff in. He didn't need it. He did that invisible. When the car goes invisible, it's just a slight convenience. He's not like, he doesn't need it. He could have just driven a bit further and not been seen. Very strange, yeah, throwing in all those bits.
Film has a very, very underwhelming ending as well. Plane sequence.
It's sad that Brosnan didn't know that that was his last film, because it was such a bad bowing out, and a lot of the Bonds get the opportunity to bow out, and I mean, Craig's had two opportunities to bow out. And some of the early ones, I mean, View to a Kill, that's again not a good opportunity, but he did know that was his last one. Whereas Brosnan's probably gone into this thinking, don't worry about this, got another one coming up.
But that also benefits his performance, because you can't deny, he's not bored. He's having fun.
No.
Like, he's having a whale of a time.
Yeah. I think when you're filming it, it looked good, but all the problems are in post.
Yeah.
Majority of those problems are just, they've messed it up in editing.
Mm.
Some of the stuff you probably didn't even know was going to happen.
Yeah.
We're talking about a science fiction action film that's come in the wake of The Matrix. And you can almost feel some of that creeping into this film.
Yeah.
There's a lot of slow-mo, weird slow-mo effects that absolutely take you out of this film.
It's like the Moonraker effect, isn't it? Where you're throwing in space stuff because because everything else is doing space, but badly. And all of this stuff in here, you can't compete with any of the... It's 2002. There's some amazing films coming out then. And some of the CGI and stuff is far superior to what you see in...
If you look at Lord of the Rings CGI compared to the CGI in Dying of the Day, which is the same year. Leagues apart.
But we were saying, when we were talking about it, you could re-edit that film and make it better by deleting most of the CGI.
Mm.
The fact that they've got it all in there just ruins it for me, because they've made it worse themselves. The good stuff's in there. It's not like they needed to add stuff in. They could have just slightly changed it and it would have been a much better film.
But this isn't Brosnan's fault, again. You know, he's put in a good performance. I mean, maybe when he stood in front of the green screen the whole time, he could have said, do we need all this?
It's Brosnan has done a service to the Bond legacy in his I think I've talked about this before, where I always see the Brosnan series as like a transitional phase. It's a mess. The whole thing is a bit of a mess. There's no consistency. I mean, the poor guy's holding it together every time. It's him that's doing it. If you'd have had another actor in there that wasn't as good as Brosnan, some of those films would have just been awful. I mean, they probably would have made money, but they're not going to be watchable. And it's a transitional phase. And what he's done in those is he's managed to generate, just hold that thing together whilst they learn what they want to do. And it was Craig's era that Barbara's probably thinking about this Craig era quite early on.
Mm. And do you think, though, in say another 10, 15 years' time, we'll look back on them, or people will look back on them, like we look back on the Roger Moore films, where we think, oh, you know, they were hokey in places, but, you know, they kept the franchise going, and I really love Roger. I feel like that's where we're headed with Piers Brosnan. I think once we get another actor after Daniel Craig, the rose-tinted glasses will come on, and we will look back at these films, and Die Another Day, where people will reappraise and say, you know, it was of its time.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I can't quite... I'd like to think that would happen. At the moment, in my mind, I can't imagine a time where I look back at that with rose-tinted glasses. But I don't know.
But the next generation might, because they'll be able to see it with that distance. We watch these films as they unfolded.
I have a feeling that the earlier Bond films, like Sean Connery and Roger Moore, in those days, that was the action star, an older man who was cool and debonair. In the 90s and early 2000s, that wasn't cool. It wasn't... Like, the action stars were young, muscular, like, technological...
Keanu Reeves, Jason Bourne,
action heroes. So, I mean, I can't imagine... I mean, for us, we were Bond fans, so we loved it. But I don't think it had the same effect on people as all the other films going on at the time. I don't think they're going to be fondly remembered by, you know, young people that didn't like Bond. Because he's not that, he wasn't that cool. He's not that cool in these films in comparison to some of the other films going on at the time.
Hmm. Well, I think we can't lay anything at Brosnan's feet on this one. You are right. It's a shame it is his last film. But what happened after Die Another Day?
Well, I thought one of the things that it didn't really happen after Die Another Day. It was a more of accumulation of the films that went on. But one of the things that crops up quite a lot throughout the Brosnan era films is the product placement. And it is madness. I mean, there's product placement in a lot of Bond films. Even from the start, it's like a big thing. But in the Brosnan era, oh my goodness, it was relentless. And you can see it with stuff like the BMW deal, where that was a three-film deal where BMW was everywhere in it. And it was the first time where Aston Martin wasn't the main car. Apparently, Die Another Day, Eon had a lot of flack from fans and critics about just the unashamed amount of product placement that was happening in these films. And apparently, the £130 million it cost to make Die Another Day had already been covered by sponsorship deals before the film had even hit the box office. So you can see that, I mean, I don't know if that's MGM who, you know, that pushing for the money to be made. And, you know, you talk about that £1 billion. That's not just box office. That's all the sponsorship deals, which is a ridiculous amount of money to make from sponsorship deals. And that's what Bond generates. And if you've got something like Bond and you know it can make £130 million through sponsorship and you're the production company or what the distributors and the stakeholders, you're going to say, do it, make that money. There's so much that goes on in those films and product placement. There's Die Another Day and Tomorrow Never Dies were the big ones. And in the earlier Bond films, it kind of fit. The products that you had in it were quite cool. Dom Perignon.
Aspirational,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and all these cool brands. Even like Sony and stuff in the earlier ones were still, you can see Bond using those things. But as it comes into the Tomorrow Never Dies ones, it's just anything. It's like L'Oreal, obviously BMW, Sony Ericsson, Heineken, all these brands that are just thrown in. Die Another Day's got just 7-Up and Visa, Energizer, Best Buy, British Airways, Skidoo, just so many brands that they've just thrown into this kind of deals, which they just don't fit. And if it doesn't fit with Bond, like it's not an Aston Martin, it's not a Briani suit, it's just jarring. And there was a lot of fallout that came off the back end of it. And a lot of people were saying, these brands aren't even British. He's got a Swedish phone. He's got a German car. It's no longer, you know, Bond smart product placement. It's just an advert. But and Brosnan talks about it as well. And I think there's various accounts where Brosnan's not too keen on all this product placement that's going in the films. But he did say by the end of it, he talks about Fleming. Fleming actually puts a lot of product placement in his books as well. He has reference to things, yeah. But it's all Bond product placement. It's things Bond would use to explain Bond.
Yeah.
So I don't quite agree with this, but he says he wrote about the Sea Island linen shirts. He wrote about the Bollinger. He wrote about the cigarettes. He wrote about the watches. He wrote about the cars. So the die was cast there with Fleming. It's one of the things that you kind of have to make peace with, really, and I have. But all those things are cool, whereas 7-Up isn't cool.
Yeah, so, Ian Fleming wasn't writing them into the books as a part of a deal, was he?
No, it was to explain the character.
To explain the character, yeah.
Which is a smart way to explain a character by what products they use in exactly. Associations. So yeah, I don't agree with that at all. But that's something that, I mean, it continues into the Craig ones.
Yeah.
The product placement.
It's even bigger now, right, with the Craig ones.
But there are some jarring product placements in Craig, but to an extent, a lot of them, the product placements are smart. They do fit with it. But yeah, there's no way of getting away from it now. I think once you've built that behemoth of making money from sponsorships, is never going to be able to, you can't stop it.
No.
That's part of why it's so popular. And I imagine in the 90s, they were so, especially in the early 90s when they started making these, money was a massive worry. So if you can make the money for the film before you've started, sorted, and it can tank.
Yeah.
So after Die Another Day, Brosnan did, you know, was talking up his future as Bond. He told reporters at the time, "The producers have told me the role is mine as long as I like." And in another interview, he said, "I would like to do another one, sure. Connery did six. Six would be a good number, and then I would never come back." So he was dead set on making at least a couple more after after Die Another Day. And according to Martin Campbell, who obviously directed Casino Royale and GoldenEye, the next film in development was going to be another original story. It wasn't always going to be Casino Royale. So Martin Campbell said in an interview in 2012, Casino Royale was not going to be the next film. They were developing another script. But then, after a long battle, the Broccolis suddenly got the film rights to the first Bond novel, Casino Royale, despite Quentin Tarantino bidding against them. And this is where Quentin Tarantino sort of comes into the story, because Tarantino famously wanted to make a Bond film with Brosnan. He was a huge fan of Brosnan. And actually, I could go into a lot of detail about Tarantino, and I think we will do, save it for the tea for Tarantino in a later episode. So I won't go too much into it. The idea is that Tarantino was bidding it to get hold of the Casino Royale rights with Sony, because Sony had the rights at that point, to make his rival Bond film. Mm-hmm. But and that really caught the attention of the Broccolis, who then thought, no, we want to do this. And that's really why it put Casino Royale on the table. That's according to Martin Campbell. Don't know how true mm-hmm. that is. So Tarantino was upset about losing out on the chance there. He said, it would have been my James Bond film, not a Cubby Broccoli Bond film, and I would have done it with Piers Brosnan. And he cites Brosnan as being like the best James Bond in his opinion, which, you know, is an interesting choice for a filmmaker like Tarantino. You think a discerning filmmaker like that mm. might go for, you know, a bit of a snobby choice, you know. But actually, no, he says Brosnan's best. And I think that chimes with what we're saying, right?
Yeah,
he was a great Bond. Yeah. The Bond films maybe weren't yeah. up to.
And, mm-hmm. and you can kind of see something like The Matador. Yeah. That feels very Tarantino-esque in how he plays that. And you can Absolutely. And he's quite versatile in what he does. So you can see Bond, you can see Brosnan changing the way he does Bond towards a more Tarantino style, which is a testament to Brosnan. He does a lot of different roles, and he pulls them all off really well.
So Casino Royale became part of the plan because the rights had come to back to Eon in 1999 after the Kevin McClory situation was finally settled. But according to reports, it was salary demands from Piers Brosnan that caused issues. Now, Brosnan denies this, but it's obviously you're never going to get to the bottom of the truth. But apparently, Brosnan's agent was asking for $25 million for the fifth film, plus 5% gross. And 5% gross is massive on a Bond film, right? They said no. Brosnan arranged a face-to-face meeting with Barbara and Michael to appeal his case. And they just said no. He said that there was not even a chance to appeal. He said he was just completely kicked to the curb. Even though this meeting, they said that we're going to go down a different route. He still felt like there was a chance that he could still come back, because as with the case with Eon, until they announce the next actor, yeah. you know, the current incumbent Bond is the Bond yeah. of on record, right? Mm-hmm. Sony then bought MGM in 2004, and this delayed the development of the next Bond film after Die Another Day. And I think it was this whole change in management and change in the post 9/11 era. They just thought, you know. Yeah. They were looking at Casino Royale. It's the first Bond book. It was going to be a reboot, a rehash, a restart. And it just felt like, you know, that it was time for a new face. And so this is Brosnan talking about losing the role. He said, there's no regret, he says now. I do not let regret come into my world. It just leads to more misery and more regrets. Bond is the gift that keeps giving and has allowed me to have a wonderful career. Once you're branded as a Bond, it's with you forever. So you better make peace with it. You better understand that when you walk through those doors and pick up the mantle of being James Bond. So there was a time where he thought he was going to play Bond for a fifth time. He was in Malibu and they called him and said, we'd like you to do the fifth. He said, I'd love to. He told his wife, Keely, go and build your dream house because I'm doing the movie. They've just invited me back. He went off then to make another film in the interim time, a film called After the Sunset. And one day he said he was going to the set. The phone rang. It was his agent and said, they've started negotiations on the film. And he said, oh, what does that mean? He says, well, they don't want to negotiate anymore. They'll call you next Thursday. He said, okay. So he waited a week. Next Thursday came. He was then in the Bahamas, Richard Harris's house. I don't know if you can remember, but there is a connection to Richard Harris through his first wife, Cassandra. But yeah, Barbara and Michael called. They said they'd rethought the character, and that was it. They were putting him to bed as Bond. They said goodbye. He said that was it. They told him you were a good Bond, and this is what he said. He said that's how it went down at the time, and that certainly dug into the solar plexus of life, just because it was pretty gut wrenching, and because it had been somewhat heralded that I was coming back. but that's just business, and you're the one caught in the crosshairs.
Yeah.
Apparently, his press agent at the time told him that he should announce that he was resigning from the role, as Timothy Dalton had done. Mm. But he said that he didn't want to do that. He said that would have been a lie to himself, and that it was their decision that they would have to be the ones to announce it. So,
yeah,
he says you get on and you work. You just get back in the ring and try to define yourself and not let there be angst over it. Head up, shoulders back. Yeah. So that was it. He'd been dealt that blow, and that was his career as Bond over. And not long after that, they announced Daniel Craig as the next Bond for Casino Royale, the film he wanted to make.
Yeah. Sad, but if you think about it, if you're going to reboot a series, it's all you can do. You can't hold on for another two films with a man. Poor old Brosnan.
Especially in this new era with new owners of MGM, if they were looking at it saying we want a whole new era of James Bond, they want a new face, right? They want to put their own stamp on it.
There's nothing you could have done with Brosnan. It would have been, what was he, 49 in Die
49.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, he was looking good in it. I think he could have made one more, maybe two, if they'd done them quickly. But you can't plan the next stage of a business based on that. It would have just been a couple of quick wins and that'd be it.
I think for me, sentimental point of view, I think he deserved one more. There might not be any Bond without him.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he deserved one more, and it would have been good. But yeah, you couldn't halt the process, could you?
No, but it didn't deter him from making films in any way, shape, or form. I'm going to rattle through these because he's done over 30 films since
Are we going to do a separate one on your love of Mamma Mia?
That's in here, don't worry. I'm going to just skim across it.
Okay.
So, yeah, he made Evelyn. He made After the Sunset. He was on set for that when he discovered he'd lost the role. And in 2005, as you mentioned earlier, The Matador. That is probably as close as you're going to get to a Tarantino performance from Brosnan. And I watched this last week. And so it's about a businessman played by Greg Kinnear and like a end of his career, jaded hitman played by Pierce Brosnan. They meet in a bar and they strike up a unlikely friendship. And he's not, you know, he's a problematic character, problematic man, you know, he's flawed and he plays it so well. It was nominated for some awards, but it's very under the radar and did do well at the box office. But if you ever get to check it out, it's called The Matador. I would 100%
recommend. It's almost impossible
that.
To find anywhere.
Yeah, just try and track it down. He did Seraphim Falls with another actor that was
Liam Neeson.
Considered for the role of Bond. Yes, Liam Neeson. So he did that in 2006. He's doing a film every year, but I'm going to go to the big ones. 2008, which is his highest grossing post-Bond that he's been involved with, it is Mamma Mia. $52 million budget, and it made $615 million. So the story is, it's set on a Greek island with a bride called Sophie. She doesn't
He's been waiting for this. Lock the doors.
Come on, just skip to the end.
She doesn't know who her father is, so she's invited three men to the island to her wedding in order to find out who her father is and to give her away, all to the soundtrack of ABBA songs. And Pierce Brosnan plays one of the guys alongside Colin Firth and Sarsgaard. What's his first name?
Alexander.
Stellan.
Who am I talking about?
His son? Are you talking about his son?
Is that his son?
Yeah, oh, that's right. His son.
Would have been interesting if he played the role.
Yeah. So he said about the film, it was great fun, had the time of my life from day one all the way to the end, apart from the terror of singing. But once you got that under your belt and you came to the theatricality of it and you made peace with your voice, it was wonderful to be in the company. So, you know, he had a great time, and I can't recommend that highly enough if you want something feel good and throw away. It's as good as it is terrible. That's, you know, that's all I can say.
Same thing
about
you say about Die Another Day.
In 2010, he did The Ghost Writer, And he played former Prime Minister Adam Lang, and he based that performance on Tony Blair. It was also, he got Irish Film and TV Award for Best Supporting Actor, and he was nominated for other awards as well. So that's another one to look out for. Solid performance there. Probably not enough Brosnan for my liking. But if you like Ewan McGregor, then there's plenty of Ewan McGregor in that. It was in Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief. And he played a centaur called Chiron. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yep.
He did a film called Love Is All You Need in 2013. But in 2013, he also did The World's End, where he played Guy Shepherd. Interestingly, which is part of the Cornetto trilogy. And interestingly, in the previous one, in Hot Fuzz, Timothy Dalton plays. So they've...
Well, I was thinking about this, and it's just a shame they didn't have, like, Lazenby or somebody in the first one,
I was thinking exactly the same, yeah.
Yeah.
That would have been brilliant.
Or Moore would have been amazing in it, and he probably would have done it.
Yes. Yeah. But I think they're too consciously... They're casting that consciously, aren't they? Surely.
Oh, they did the second one.
Definitely.
The first one was asleep. Well, it was low budget. They weren't that famous. They probably couldn't get those stars in. But yeah, and then they were just basically pandering to their like teen loves, weren't they? Getting all their favourite actors in from all their 80s films. But yeah, they probably couldn't do it the first one, which is a shame.
Yeah. So 2014, he did Love Punch, Long Way Down, November Man. November Man, he plays a spy again. So he keeps playing spies or that sort of character quite a lot. He looks good when he's holding a gun, doesn't he? So who knows?
Yeah, he's got that down.
2016, he made Urge, which has got 0% on Rotten Tomatoes, so probably don't recommend that one.
That sounds like it's worth watching. I'd love to see a 0%er.
And he also did a film that I clicked on. I was like, It. He made It. It's not It. It's IT.
IT.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the front cover of that. It's questionable front cover.
Fair enough. He was also executive producer on that. The Foreigner, which is on Netflix, is directed by Martin Campbell, who he worked with on GoldenEye, of course. Mm-hmm. And the sequel to Mamma Mia in 2018, again, another hit. $75 million budget, $395 million at the box office.
That's quite a lot lower, though, isn't it? I'm surprised by that.
It is, yeah. Well, they don't do it. They do the B-sides. That's the problem. And he said about this one, I don't sing as much in this one, but there's certainly a sense of cringe making when it comes to singing. You're very vulnerable. One is very vulnerable. Singing is not necessarily...
It's a karaoke film, isn't it? That's what people like about it, that Brosnan isn't quite that good professional singer.
Singing is not necessarily my forte. I enjoy singing. I'm not quite sure other people enjoy my singing, but they have good entertainment value out of my singing, which is very true. It's widely panned how bad and compared to... You know, awful sort of sounds.
To his credit,
sort of
though,
barking out.
He plays it as that. That's how he plays it. People know he's not a good singer in it, and people love it because of that. Because he's not that bothered about it. It's I think he comes off very well. And I've only seen the first one, Brendan. I apologise, but it does come off very well.
You need to brush up on your Mamma Mia. But no, he. I mean, in all of these films, it doesn't matter if he's in a total turkey. He's good value. You know, he'll put in a performance. It's just necessarily the script is not always the best.
Yeah, he's Roger Moore, isn't he? People just love him.
Final Score, which is basically Die Hard in a football stadium, is the way that Sky sort of promoted it as.
People that love Die Hard but always wanted to see it in a football stadium.
So that was actually shot at Upton Park, which is West Ham Football Club's stadium. As it was being knocked down, they say blew that to smithereens. And he plays a bad guy in that. So if you want to see Pierce Brosnan sort of going against his normal character, then this is the one for you. Eurovision, I've not seen. Have either of you seen Eurovision?
No.
He plays Will Ferrell's dad, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And then upcoming, he's going to be in Cinderella 2021. And then that brings us to... There is also a lost film called The King's Daughter, which was shot in 2014 and has gone missing.
That's a Chinese film, I think, is it?
Gone missing.
Gone missing from the release schedule. It's not; they haven't lost it.
Right. I was really excited by that. Delve into that a bit more.
Not like a Dad's Army episode or anything.
Steptoe.
But he plays Louis the 14th. I've seen a clip of it. He looks good. He's got the long hair, you know. But yeah, don't know when the release is coming for that.
I'd love to see him back as Bond in a sort of Logan-esque
one last mission. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Well, another Never Say Never Again.
Yeah.
They should have but wouldn't it be great if every Bond was contracted to do a Never Say Never Again 10 years later?
Oh.
But I'd just love to see him one more time as Bond. I think it would be an amazing opportunity after Daniel Craig just to do a one-off.
Yeah.
Give the fans what they really want and then start afresh with the new one. It'd be an amazing opportunity. But he looks so good now as well with his white hair and his white beard. Yeah, he looks like Colonel Sanders, but like...
Yeah.
His little twizzled moustache.
Yeah.
I think that's an absolute pipe dream though, isn't it?
Yeah, not going to happen. What else is there to say about his post-Bond life?
Well, in his personal life, the biggest thing that's happened to him, and you see here in all of his photos from premieres to speeches that he does, is he married a lady called Keely Shea Smith. Now, for the UK listeners, we don't really know much about Keely. Her main fame, apart from being married to Brosnan, is that she's an American journalist, an author, a television host, and an actress. She's had two sons with Brosnan, Dylan Thomas and Paris Beckett Brosnan. But yes, she was famous for presenting loads of different shows in America, none of which we'd have ever seen in the UK. Kind of like, This Morning type shows and stuff like that. But an interesting fact is that, and you should check this out, is she played the main kind of love interest in Huey Lewis in the News music video, Stuck With You, which I watched yesterday, which I completely forgot about that song, but it's very good. And yeah, she's like the main love interest in that, so it's worth watching. She was also an actress in, she played Valerie Freeman in General Hospital, which I've never seen, probably not going to either. Aside from those kind of, jobs that she's had originally, she's most famous or most active as kind of a really important person in environmental ethics, all that kind of stuff, which of course Brosnan is, and I know Brendan's going to talk about that in a bit. So I won't go into depth about all that, but a lot of her past career is all about kind of the presenting role she did around those areas, and probably something that maybe caused them to meet, because obviously they've both got big interests in all those kind of things around environment and natural resources. They met on a beach in Mexico in 1994, so just before GoldenEye was eventually released, or year before GoldenEye was released, and then didn't get married until August in 2001 in County Mayo in Ireland. But yeah, apart from that, she still works very much with Brosnan on a lot of projects, but obviously she's more famous now for always being with him, and he mentions her in a lot of the speeches he does, a lot of, when he did the Walk of Fame, he talked about her there. So that's Keely Shea Smith, or Keely Shea Brosnan, as she's now known. Interestingly, Dying of the Day wasn't the last time that Pierce Brosnan played Bond in some form. In 2003, the Everything or Nothing computer game was released across multiple formats, so PlayStation 2, Xbox, GameCube, and also had a different version that was released on the Game Boy Advance, which I think I've got, so I might play that later tonight to see what it's like. It was enormously successful. It sold 5 million copies worldwide, making it the second most successful game in the series. I think you can probably guess what the first one was. It's a third-person shooter. It's got its own storyline. The cast list is phenomenal. It's got, as well as Brosnan, it's got Judi Dench, Willem Dafoe, and John Cleese, along with a load of other actors, so pretty big budget. You can see that they were really trying to push it. I think probably trying to relive that GoldenEye success from many years ago, which they'd obviously tried with a few games and it didn't work. But yeah, they instead of focusing on the game, it sounds like they focused more on the storyline than they did in GoldenEye. But it was written by the scriptwriter, Bruce Feirstein, who did, of course, who worked on GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies. And the plot's connected to Roger Moore's A View to a Kill, which seems a very strange concept. I don't know why they've done that. Yeah, so it got a lot of positive reviews. I watched a few videos of it. I've never actually played it. It's it's very much as you'd expect from a game of that era. It looks like a mix of Metal Gear Solid, little bit of GTA. It's very, a little bit of Time Crisis as well. But it's just shooting constantly, running around. And some of the cutscenes are really funny. So if you go in, just look for Everything or Nothing cutscenes. And I mean, back in those days, the computer graphics for cutscenes wasn't great. But when you try and make a computer cutscene in those days look like the character, it's so bad. That's why in GoldenEye, it looks fine because they're not meant to be like the people. They're not trying to make it look like Pierce Brosnan. But obviously, he's voicing this really bad character creation of his Bond character. It's just stupid. Well worth a look though, but I'm not sure if it's worth playing. I think you've played it, haven't you, Brendan?
Yeah, years ago when it first came out. Yeah, I remember enjoying it. So
I'm not sure how I missed that one, but I've not been able to get not able to play it on anything. So I might see if I can get an emulator for that. But yeah, Everything or Nothing. The last time Brosnan played Bond.
Well, let's round things off now, just with a sort of brief mention of a couple more things, just that it would be remiss to leave out if talking profiling Brosnan. One being his work as an artist. If you follow him on Instagram, he's always touting his paintings that he's done. And if you remember back when we did the first episode, he that was his passion, right? Painting when he was at school. That was very much his one of his great loves. And he really took it up again in 1987 when Cassandra fell ill. He said that he finds it therapeutic. In an interview, he said, I started painting again in 1987 when my late wife had cancer. I'd been painting out of the pain, and now the pain sometimes comes out in colour. He says that I classify myself as a colourist. I enjoy the vibrancy of great colours. I love trying to create something that's beautiful. Art for me has become more of a focal point in my life. And he's got a studio in his house, and he's working on art all the time. Interestingly, when Keighley had a documentary at Cannes, they asked him to submit a piece of art for an auction, the Amphar AIDS auction. He'd just done a painting of Bob Dylan. He put it up for auction, sold for $1.4 million.
Wow.
Well, it's definitely insane.
If you want to be an artist, it's definitely worth being a Bond first, because you're probably going to get a little bit more interest in your paintings after that.
But yeah, so he's always talking about putting on exhibitions and stuff, and yeah, worth checking out.
Yeah, he's recently just been. I've seen a lot of posts where he's posting about the earplugs
thing
he did during GoldenEye.
And
there's a lot of, I didn't talk about it. It was so stressful working on Bond films, as we you know from all of the actors that talk about it, that you don't just get normal downtime. So he had to do things to kind of keep his mind off work, and he did yoga and stuff. But yeah, painting was a big one during the breaks that he'd have on set. And I think that's a great painting of the earplugs.
Mm. Yeah, very pop arty, isn't it? And Brendan, you're going to talk about his charity work.
Yeah, I thought finally we'd just touch on his sort of charity work and activism. He's been an ambassador for UNICEF Ireland since 2001, along with Liam Neeson. So they did a video together a few years back to promote it. He's also big against the protection of marine life and the conservation of wetlands, so much so that he was awarded a Green Cross Leadership Award by Mikhail Gorbachev in 1997, who called Pierce a truly committed leader whose bold actions and clever voice have been instrumental in marine mammal protection, as well as that of fragile ecosystems. Together with his wife, they are quite keen to protect all the marine life, and also a bit closer to home, where they own a house in Hawaii, and they donated $100,000 to replace a playground. They also donated a large portion of their proceeds from their wedding, so they obviously got coverage from that, and donated it to help build a Tibetan school. So it means that the kids can have classes there. And also the profits from his sales, as we mentioned with the paintings, that is distributed by the Brosnan Trust to charities throughout that are of the interest of him and his wife. And he also, I just thought I'd finish on this quote: "If I hadn't been an actor, I probably would have been a social worker. Acting is great, but sometimes it can feel rather redundant in a world which is flying by the seat of its pants." So you can see that, like, throughout his career, like, he's very keen to have a voice,
yeah,
you know, and help those in need.
Yeah, I mean, not even his kind of extracurricular stuff. Even in, you can see from his personal life, he's very keen on helping people, and he's a very giving man. He's
very dignified. Yeah, very dignified. Yeah, and I think he's used his fame well, very much like Connery and Roger Moore did as well. You know, they're very much dedicated to helping others with their
it's strange that. I don't know if that's as a result of Bond, but it's definitely an ethos that runs through them.
Yeah, I think it just sort of speaks a lot about, you know, the people behind the Bond films as well, who really want to work with the really dignified people. You don't see these people in too many scandals. But yeah, I guess it, in summing up then, how would you sort of define Brosnan's era as Bond?
In a word, I would say important. I think without the era and what he did, and to pull in the performances that he did, because he didn't have the greatest scripts, or not necessarily, you know, the crew working on it, it all didn't come together as well, but he remained professional and he put in a performance that was worthy of all of the other ones. You know, he's up there.
Yeah. I think he's brilliant. I think there's a lot of unfairness with Brosnan as a series. I think if you look at Roger obviously did a lot more films. Some of them weren't great, some of them were good, but he had so many that he just, it's fine. He did some bad ones, did some good ones. Same with Connery. Connery's a good. So you have that kind of longevity where you look back and you go, brilliant. Just, you can pick out the two or three best ones. Don't worry about the other ones. Brosnan didn't have that opportunity. He got four and he didn't get dealt the best hand. And it was the time he was in. It was the way that the whole broccoli system was working at the time. He got dealt some bad hands, but he made a great job of it. And despite all that, he still goes down as, you know, one of the top Bonds. And I think I'm pretty clear that we're big fans of Brosnan. But yeah, I think he's just did a tremendous job, but just to get dealt the best hand.
I totally agree. Great Bond, let down possibly by having, not been dealt. I think that's a great phrase, not been dealt the best hand in terms of the Bond films that he worked on. But he really made the most of it. And as I said before, whether this is something we were talking about before, I feel like he's the first actor who really wanted to play Bond. You know, Connery, he got the role when Bond wasn't a thing. Lazenby sort of fell into the part for the fame, almost. That might be unfair on Lazenby. Yeah. Roger Moore, you know, he was destined to play that role because of everything that he'd done before. He was just playing that type, right? The Saint.
Yeah.
Oh, that's,
well, I love Roger, but Roger was just happy doing it, wasn't he? He was so pleased to get it. He wasn't.
It was just an extension of him, isn't it? That's what I feel about Roger Moore, and I love Roger Moore. I'd say he's probably my favourite go-to Bond to watch at any time. But
it felt like it was handed to him, and he was just thank you very much.
Yeah, and it was an extension of that, and he was great. He was effortless. He made it look effortless. Dalton, you know, he got dealt a bum hand. He's a great actor. Who, you know, from looking into it from Brosnan, was almost the second choice for it. He wanted to do something different. He tried it. It didn't work out. I don't feel like he was ever backed that well by everything else around it. But Brosnan comes into it. He loves the role. He wants the role. He wants to play the role. He could have played the role for another 10 years if he'd been let. But
And if you think about it, there's a lot of debate over Bond as to... Some people love Roger. Some people don't like Roger. Some people love Connery. Some people don't. Everybody just likes Brosnan. He may not be everyone's favourite. He may not be that many people's favourite, but he's consistently liked by everyone. And I think that's the thing with his films. I enjoy watching them. I mean, Connery's my favourite at the moment, but Brosnan's not. I mean, he's still up there.
Yeah. One for the Hall of Fame. I mean,
well, you'd expect if he wasn't in the Hall of Fame. I mean, you have to question this Hall of Fame.
Oh, what an epic journey we've been on with Piers Brosnan. Mm. I can't wait to talk about someone else next week. Where we will finally move on to the letter C. I can't believe we've done two letters and we've still got... Thankfully, some of the letters have only got like one or two entries. So when we get to X, we'll be like... Yeah, it's going to be...
I'm sure we'll find something.
Scrattling around for anything.
But the next Bond actor we'll do will be Connery, I guess, which is going to be another epic special.
Well, C is going to be one hell of a ride, isn't it? Because we've got a lot going in there, a lot of specials.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then D.
Yeah, it's going
to
be...
Oh, yeah, got two Casino Royales to do, Connery. Oh,
Craig.
Yeah. Craig.
We're going to be on C till the summer.
Which summer? Anyway, thank you so much for listening. As always, please leave us a review or, you know, a comment wherever you're listening to this podcast. We really appreciate it. How can people find us on social media? Who wants to take that?
At James Bond A to Z. And that's on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook.
And if you want to email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. James Bond will return in the next episode.
Thanks a lot.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingermels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.